Is it too embarrassing? Should I take it off? You're just too embarrassing. Right, okay.
David is the author of two excellent books, at least that I know of, Heidegger Ethics and the Practice of Ontology, a subject close to my heart certainly, and a very recent book on Foucault's Archaeology of Knowledge, both of which you can find in the library, and they're very important works. David's also very active in the British Society for Phenomenology and has been instrumental, I think, in bringing it up to date, let's say, and making it a very important organisation in British philosophy, I think. Also the author of some very important articles on Cavaillère, the French philosopher of science, and Husserl, among many others. Foucault again, of course, and Foucault's background in the French philosophy of science, which is a background that was all too often neglected by Foucault interpreters in the English-speaking world. And another article I like very much on Derrida and friendship, I think to remember. So, I'll leave you to announce the is the title of the talk today? Was it Nihilism?
As it was just under a week ago, I think, yes. Nihilism, Technology and Neoliberalism.
Nihilism, Technology and Neoliberalism. I hand you over to David.
Thank you. Well, it's a great pleasure to come down to see many friends and to be here and have a chance to talk to you about a few things. Now, thank you for your very kind introduction. I have to say that the topic I'm talking about doesn't bear very much obvious relation to almost any of the topics above mentioned. So I should sort of explain a little bit about sort of why I'm talking about this, I suppose. Although I have to say I'd be very happy should actually topics to do with Foucault and archaeology and some background of philosophy of sciences and that kind of thing. Should you like me to come back and talk about that some other time, I'd be more than happy to do so. But anyway, on this occasion, I wanted to talk a little bit about this topic, nihilism, technology, and neoliberalism. And as usual, I think, when one finds oneself getting interested in a problem or a set of ideas, there are no doubt many reasons why you find yourself kind of moving in that direction. The most immediate and pressing is that I'm supposed to be writing about nihilism at the moment, so that sort of focused my thoughts a little bit on the topic. But there are other reasons too. The kind of problems that I'm going to introduce here are ones that I feel are important, pressing, I suppose, worth giving thought to now. However, I should also say this before I start. The talk I'm giving today is not a long talk, and really what I'm doing is not, I hope you'll bear with me on this, presenting the fruit of many, many hours of careful kind of deliberation and work, but really what I'm doing is kind of putting together some ideas which in a way which has occurred to me might be interesting to put these ideas together in a certain kind of way and thereby to raise a certain question, really. So I'm putting together a few things. None of it is going to be desperately hello there. That wasn't a face I was expecting. Not the right stride there. Goodness me. The Lisa? The yes, you need to be up with us at that chair.
So what I want to do is put together a few ideas. I think it would be fairly straightforward to follow. Each of these kind of themes I'm putting together deserves a great deal further, more exploration and development. But I want to put them together at least in such a way I think it raises a question, which seems to me is an interesting one. So, and I hope at least that will be a useful and interesting basis for a discussion. You can tell me whether you think I'm on an interesting track or not, in this case maybe. Okay. It's easy then, I would say, to treat nihilism, the main theme of this talk, as a phenomenon that belongs to history, in the sense that it happened at an identifiable point in history, for identifiable reasons, had effects that continue to ripple through our present, gently, and yet which somehow doesn't quite really concern us anymore, as if it no longer bore directly on our present, let alone our future. In a similar way, the fact that nihilism is a well-established theme in philosophy means that as philosophers we may find ourselves approaching it with the same detachment we bring to problems in epistemology or metaphysics. Such problems matter, they're important, but they can be viewed, shall we say, objectively. But such intellectual good conscience is likely to be hiding something from itself or from us. Moreover, Nietzsche famously declared that the events he described would cast a shadow, a long shadow, over the future of European culture. So there's good reason to suppose that nihilism is still with us. I therefore think it's important not to treat nihilism as an event in the past or as a philosophical problem remote from our lives, from how we live, and that one should ask in what form, if any, nihilism presents itself today. In saying this, I'm not assuming that there is a fundamental definition of nihilism which then manifests itself in different ways at different times in a kind of historicist thesis. Rather, I'm interested in the way, or else shall I say, in the question of whether nihilism can still be understood today as perhaps one understood it in the past. So, I want to ask, what has nihilism become, if you like? Now, I don't have a clear answer to that question, at least not one I'm entirely happy with, but I do have a hypothesis, shall we say, a hunch, which is what I'm going to set out for you today. Now, Nietzsche is inevitably, of course, perhaps the most important point of reference here. Nietzsche provides both an account of nihilism and an indication of what form of life we would have to have, should we say, would have to emerge in order for nihilism to be overcome. Now, I want to suggest that we are today living through a historically singular convergence of technology and neoliberalism, and that it appears to constitute precisely such a form of life, perhaps unexpectedly. Yet, rather than having cause to celebrate the overcoming of nihilism and the emergence of a new form of life, there is reason to be deeply concerned at the turn events have taken. The convergence of technology and neoliberalism, I want to suggest, could be regarded as a new, or at least a distinctive, new manifestation of nihilism, in spite of the fact that it appears to satisfy many of the conditions for a form of life that overcomes nihilism. Now, if this view is correct, then it may require a reconsideration of the terms in which nihilism is understood in the present day. And that's essentially my question. Is that the case? So, I want to set out these ideas and see what you have to say about them. First of all, let me just go back and set out a basic understanding of nihilism as a point of departure. And to do this, I'll just go back to Nietzsche, who's the main point of reference for this. Nietzsche describes nihilism as the historical process by which the highest values devaluate themselves. The most concise expression of this process is the well-known chapter in The Twilight of the Idols, entitled How the Real World at Last Became a Myth. At the beginning of the story, Nietzsche tells here the real world is attainable for the wise, the pious, and the virtuous man. He dwells in it. He is it, Nietzsche writes. Then, step by step, the real world becomes less attainable, more distant, until it is finally abolished altogether. This description of the collapse of Platonism, as it's usually read, can be understood as an account of the growing realization that the overall character, these are Nietzsche's words, the overall character of existence may not be interpreted by means of the concepts of aim, the concept of unity, or the concept of truth. Existence therefore appears to lack justification and meaning, both in the sense that it is impossible to draw any justification and meaning from existence itself, and in the sense that we no longer permit ourselves a belief in a value that transcends it, that is, in an ideal of any kind. The situation was expressed by Nietzsche in The Gay Science through the character of the madman who took a lighted lantern to the marketplace one bright morning to announce that God is dead. As you know, the madman goes on to say that not only is God dead, but that, quote, we have killed him. And that by doing so, they had wiped away the horizon and unchained the earth from its sun. Elsewhere, Nietzsche tells us that these events were set in train by the triumph of slave morality and the will to truth to which it gave rise. Those for whom life was a burden, due mainly to their subjection by others, but also to the unforgiving nature of their environment, established a moral code according to which what caused them pain and hardship was evil, and they, by direct contrast, were good. Traits of weakness were elevated to positive values, and gradually a moral code was established that could affirm life only as originally weak, and as a necessary evil from which one could escape only by means of salvation. Along the way, for the purposes of attributing blame and making possible the punishment of wrongdoers, there developed a will to truth that sought to press beyond appearances, discounting them to reveal the truth behind them. Finally, as Nietzsche tells it, the determination not to deceive even oneself led to the unmasking of the belief in God as a lie that could no longer be tolerated. And this is the story he tells of the self-overcoming of Christianity. There are then two key characteristics to nihilism that I want to pick out here. Most obviously, the decline of values that had for a period of time stood over and above existence, justifying it and giving it purpose and meaning. But in addition, and more fundamentally, the initial turn against life and existence by which these values emerged in the first place. A turn that Nietzsche locates in the rise of slave morality and, following its triumph, in the emergence of the figures of the ascetic and the priest. From this point of view, metaphysics has always been nihilistic. As Nietzsche writes, the categories of reason themselves are at fault. Quote, we have measured the value of the world according to categories that refer to a purely fictitious world. What responses to this situation are possible? One could treat nihilism as if it were simply the decline of particular values, which must therefore be reinforced or replaced by new ones, without any modification of the structure by which values stand over and above the life to which they are thought to provide purpose and meaning. For example, the concept of aim, unity and truth that Nietzsche has mentioned could be rehabilitated and defended. In particular, the ideal of the human could be defended against what appears to be the destructive force of nihilism. However, there is an obvious shortcoming to such an approach, in that it fails to acknowledge that the crisis to which it responds arises from a general collapse in the structure of value, and not just the weakening of this or that particular value. As a consequence, such an approach would fail to recognise the true nature and extent of nihilism. In addition, such an approach neglects the extent to which the idea of humanity it defends is itself implicated in the history of nihilism, that is, the extent to which the ideal of humanity owes its existence to slave morality, to its values, to its will to truth, to the vision of life it recognises and promotes. Such an approach treats nihilism as a mistake that could and should be reversed. In reality, it would simply return us to an earlier stage in the history of nihilism, and would therefore in no way escape or overcome it. In Nietzsche's terms, it would promote the figure of the last man caught within the grip of nihilism far more than the overman who emerges beyond nihilism. Alternatively, if one accepts that resisting nihilism entails hanging on to a vision of the human that has already become untenable, one might see the only possible course of action lying in an affirmation of nihilism itself. Basing itself on an acceptance of the that there is no truth and that every belief is necessarily false, this would be, in Nietzsche's words, the most extreme nihilism. Yet even at this apparently extreme point of negativity, value could be found in the lack of reality associated with values. In Nietzsche's words, in their being merely a symptom of strength on the part of the value positors, a simplification for the sake of life. This, writes Nietzsche, might be a divine way of thinking, insofar as a point is reached where life affirms itself in spite of the absence of true values, and finds value in itself in doing so. From this point of view, the best response to nihilism is to accelerate the changes that it brings, including the dissolution of the figure of man, in order to arrive as soon as possible at this point where a new form of life can emerge that is capable of affirming itself, and in the course of this affirmation of creating new values. Indeed, not merely of creating new values to take the place of the old, but of valuing in a new way. Nihilism, then, on this view, would be a transitional stage opening onto the possibility of a future beyond the horizons of existence today. Such an attitude celebrates the breakdown of existing forms of humanity and the values associated with them in a way that encourages risk-taking and experimentation. Any rationale for hesitation, for holding back transformation that does away with the old ways can simply be seen as hanging on to the discredited ideals of humanity, which should instead be left behind. Values are to emerge from life itself. As Heidegger writes in his essay Nietzsche's Word, God is Dead, life takes over from the supersensory as the realm of values, and therefore to understand the overcoming of nihilism through its affirmation, one has to understand life, the concept of life. Moreover, according to Heidegger, the fundamental trait of life is, for Nietzsche, the will to power. And the will to power is the will that posits values. This is Heidegger writes back, the will that posits values and is itself the ground and realm for the dispensation of values. Now, with this in mind, let me make two brief connections. The first involves a passage from The Will to Power in which Nietzsche writes that value is the highest quantum of power that a man is able to incorporate. A man, not mankind, he writes. So the question of value concerns the individual, not mankind or humanity in general. Nietzsche goes on to say in a passage quoted by Heidegger, the viewpoint of value is the viewpoint of the conditions for the preservation increase in regard to the complex structures relatively enduring of life in the midst of becoming. Sorry for that slightly garbledish sentence, but that's it's in the Heidegger translation, so that's the way it tends to come out. The viewpoint of value is the viewpoint of the conditions for the preservation increase in regard to the complex structures, relatively enduring, of life in the midst of becoming. Such preservation and increase, writes Heidegger, mark the fundamental trait of life, and life in its essence is that which sets values. Heidegger goes on to note that in modernity, value and what is valuable had, quote, turned into a positivistic substitute for the metaphysical. This is to say that as the belief in a metaphysical reality has declined, it has been replaced by a reliance on scientific rationality, number, and measurement. While one might suppose that a positivistic attitude holds to the distinction between facts and values, holding the former in high regard and discounting the latter, the real point of this remark is that there is a tendency to act as if direction, purpose, and meaning of life could be secured by the positive sciences, which can, therefore, be regarded as having supplanted metaphysics. And I suspect that in saying this, Heidegger's got an eye on Auguste Comte, who had this view that you should look at the stages of history and the metaphysical was succeeded afterwards by the positivistic. This is to say that it's not so much that our values must themselves be empirically observable and testable, so much as that they should be determined in such a way as to be consistent with what is empirically observable and testable. Maybe in today's idiom we would say that values should be evidence-based, I'm not sure. Putting together these last couple of steps, what do we have? We have that life sets values, that value is the condition for life to grow stronger and greater, i.e. that life is oriented to self-overcoming, and that values relate to the lives of individuals, not humanity in general, that life is not teleological, it's not directed towards some final end or purpose, and that in modernity, for good or ill, it is understood positivistically, i.e. in terms of number and measurement. Now, Nietzsche himself, I'm quite sure was, was suspicious of precisely this tendency to view the world in terms of number. But if Heidegger is right, and there's good reason to think that he has a case, then he, Nietzsche, has fought something of a losing battle on this one, perhaps. So far at least. Now, Heidegger too was opposed to the idea of positivism, and his response to the context of, was to place positivism in the context of the question of being and to treat it ontologically. In particular, he aimed to set out to explain how positivism represented an impoverished or weak, narrow form of ontological disclosure, of the disclosure of being. So, turning to Heidegger's essay, The Question Concerning Technology, I'll just try to demonstrate what this means here, and at the same time then start making the link from the problematic of life outlined so far to the question of technology. Now, Heidegger describes how technology is far more than a set of instruments and tools that we use to achieve ends that we have set for ourselves. It is, he writes, a way of revealing. This means that technology influences the way that we see the world, how things in the world are present to us, are disclosed for us, how we engage with them. As, for Heidegger, the world is a totality of relations formed by our involvement with things, technology literally shapes the world. The characteristic of technology that he describes is that it sets upon nature. He says technology sets upon nature, modern technology sets upon nature, revealing it simply as a resource that can be stored, distributed and used. What Heidegger calls standing reserve. So the river is revealed as a potential source of energy, or as a source of revenue for tourism, the earth as a source of minerals, and so on. As standing reserve, things are viewed as transformable, but also as what can be secured and regulated. For Heidegger, this is an impoverished form of disclosure that narrows down our relation to things and threatens to block our access to a more original relation to being. But the dominance of technology as a way of revealing also contains a specific threat that humankind, humanity, human beings, will themselves be taken as standing reserve. At this point, we too would become a resource, transformable. We too would be something to be secured and regulated. Now, Heidegger's essay on technology, the question concerning technology, influenced a good many people, including philosophers such as Arnold Galen, Jacques Ellul and Hans Jonas, who wrote a lot about technology. They developed a series of related approaches to technology, the question of technology, and then one significant view that they shared, and that was in large part drawn from Heidegger, is that technology has become autonomous, therefore no longer a tool outside of our direct management in any way. It's an idea that Heidegger himself kind of introduces in his essay, in as much as he makes it clear that we cannot understand technology as a tool, as an instrument that we use. But Galen, Ellul, Jonas develop this in a new direction. To illustrate what I mean here, let me give a brief example from the work of Arnold Galen to begin with. He refers to a report on the relationship between technology and industry, it's very old now, written in 1960, in which he observes that technology is no longer developed, even then, over 50 years ago now, no longer developed to accomplish a task that has been identified in advance. Rather, technology creates a kind of abstract ability, and it is only later that a decision is made as to what it's for. What is good can therefore be identified neither with a particular end that you're pursuing, nor specifically with an improvement in our means, in the means at our disposal for achieving that end, a particular end. Instead, it is good to improve existing processes, speed, processing power, we might say today, or to devise an innovation that opens up a potentially new field of development. Perhaps today we would think of graphene. Nobody knows what it's for yet, but it looks really exciting. Right? We'll do great stuff with it soon. Right? Or biotechnology. Again, nobody knows quite what they're going to do with this, but it's really exciting. We can do it. Let's see if we can, you know, find out what's possible. Ethical and political reasoning finds itself continually challenged by technological development, and they argue unable to bring it under control. In Jacques Ellul's words, a moral proposition will not be deemed valid for our time if it cannot enter the technological system and be consistent with it. It's a bit like theology in the old days. At the same time, as technology becomes increasingly integrated with both science and the economy, and that's a point they make quite specifically, as technology becomes increasingly integrated with both science and the economy, forms of activity that might have put technology to use or called it into question themselves become part of the way that technology operates in a more extended sense. As Jacques Ellul writes, economy can be a means of development, conditioned for technological progress, or inversely, it can be an obstacle. But never does it determine, provoke, or dominate that progress. like political authority, an economic system that challenges the technological imperative is doomed. Within this framework, Elul and Jonas describe how technology, or the nexus of technology, science and economy, generates values of its own. Elul, again, writes, "Technology has destroyed all previous scales of value. It impugns the judgments coming from outside. After all, it wrecks their foundations. But, being thus self-justified, it quite normally becomes justifying. What was done in the name of science was just. Now the same holds true for what is done in the name of technology. It attributes justice to human action, and man is thus spontaneously led to construct an ethics on the basis of, and in terms of, technology. Thus, technology demands certain values from human beings." Elul, writing about 25, 30 years ago, names those of precision, exactness, seriousness. Today, we might add other values to that list, maybe flexibility, compliance, availability, creativity, perhaps. Times have changed, and ideas were just mentioned might be more the conditions of successful and productive work today than the ones that Elul initially mentioned, but it seems to me that we're in a very similar situation in general. Jean-François Lyotard tells a similar story in The Postmodern Condition of how the virtue of performativity has become a new legitimating principle, even in the production of knowledge. Now, what these authors have described then in conjunction with science and the economy achieving an autonomous condition of becoming in which it creates its own values which then serve to promote its own growth still further. This looks remarkably like a form of life, perhaps even like a form of life as described by Nietzsche, that is, like a form of life similar to that which might be expected to emerge from the intensification of nihilism to the point where its negativity tips into an affirmation of life, as described above, a bit earlier on, albeit a form of life unlike that which previously characterized the human. Could it be, then, that technology heralds the transition to a condition of life beyond nihilism? Moreover, does the increasing hybridity of the human and the technological, celebrated in the idea of the transhuman and the cyborg, does this mark the displacement of the old humanity by new and increasingly specialised forms of life? I'll have to leave that question just hanging for a short while. We will come back to it. The picture changes again, becoming more complex and, I would say, worrying, when one takes account of the developments in political economy that run alongside the transformation in technology described. The last 50 years have seen the emergence of neoliberalism and its rise to a dominant position. Now, while neoliberalism is too big a topic to introduce and address fully here, there are two certainly key points that I think are important and that I want to outline here. These are the introduction of the idea of human capital and the extension of an economic analysis to areas of life that were not previously treated in economic terms, and the consequence of that. Taking the first one, human capital. The economist Theodor Schultz was one of the first people to introduce the idea of human capital. In a paper entitled Investment in Human Capital, written in 1961, he describes how the classical notion of labour as a capacity to do manual work is measured essentially in terms of the time spent at work and the number of workers. But this is, he argues, a blunt instrument. It is as if one were to calculate the industrial strength of a nation by counting the number of machines it has, regardless of what they do or whether they work properly. A more meaningful evaluation would take into account the kind of machine, how well it functions, what is it for, etc. The same, he said, is true of workers themselves. Each is capable of different kinds, levels and quantities of work, and it therefore makes sense, he suggested, to refer to a measure that takes this into account. His proposal was to treat individuals as human capital. From this perspective, a worker who is not very able or not very enthusiastic has less capital than a worker who is well trained and committed. For the worker, therefore, the best way to improve their position is to become better trained, better educated, or in some way to raise the value of their own human capital. That is, the worker should invest in himself or herself in order to improve their future earning potential. In this way, the worker is encouraged to engage in continual self-improvement and to become an entrepreneur of themselves. As we'll see in a moment, this may take various forms. The way that work itself is viewed, and not just the worker, also changes. Whereas classical theory, as already noted, viewed work from the perspective of the system as a whole, the theory of human capital adopts the perspective of the worker as an individual who makes choices. The question then is, why work? The obvious answer is something like, in order to get paid so I can pay the rent or buy food or whatever it might be. But, consistent with treating the worker as an individual and not simply as an anonymous and replaceable provider of labour, the money the worker receives is not simply pay for an agreed quantity of labour, but is treated as an income. That is, as an income on the human capital which he or she is, as opposed to has. It's important that it's actually is there. The individual is a sum of human capital. The larger or greater the capital, the larger or greater the income that comes as a return. So, individuals are treated as human capital, and each is an entrepreneur of oneself, committed to something like self-improvement, whatever that is going to mean, to build up their own capital. In his analysis of neoliberalism in the Birth of Biopolitics, Foucault identifies a very important correlate of this change in the relationship between work and the individual and life. Right? One that is reflected in the analyses of education, family life and criminality that were carried out by the economist Gary Becker, again back originally in the 1960s. He proposed that even areas such as these, education, family life, criminality and so on, that had traditionally fallen outside the strict terms of economic debate, could be understood in terms of investment and return. Foucault, reflecting on this in The Birth of Biopolitics, writes, "The generalization of the economic form of the market beyond monetary exchanges functions in American neoliberalism as a principle of intelligibility and a principle of decipherment of social relationships and individual behaviour. This means that an analysis in terms of the market economy, or in other words, of supply and demand, can function as a schema which is applicable to non-economic domains." That's Foucault. In short, an economic form of analysis is extended to all aspects of life, where it provides what he calls a principle of intelligibility. That is, it offers a way of making sense, of evaluating what we do, both socially and as individuals. Economic analysis could then tell us whether a particular act or project is worth doing. As such, it is intimately tied up with the concept of value, as indeed the very idea of human capital would suggest. But it goes further. Because we are the sum of the human capital that bears our name, the extension of the economic form of analysis to all aspects of life makes sense of who we are, what we are worth. So, to step back a little and reflect on where we've arrived here, if technology, together with science and the economy, understood in quite general terms, could be described by Ellul as autonomous, injecting neoliberalism into this conjunction appears to reinforce its proximity to life, and specifically to human life, or, to avoid generalities, to your life and mine. More than ever, the values associated with such a form are presented in terms of perpetual growth, and specific values that are promoted that characterise life, in this case efficiency, productivity, flexibility, mobility and such like. The convergence of technology and neoliberalism therefore leads to the emergence, it seems, of what can be called a form of life that creates its own values. Only now, rather than human individuals being implicated by virtue of their hybridity with technology, the human individual has been taken over by this life, which it literally now becomes through the idea of human capital. So again, what has happened here exactly? Is this the outcome of the self-overcoming of humanity? Should it be welcomed as an experimental form in which the old ideals of humanity have fallen away and left behind, as appears to be necessary, would appear to be necessary for any historical escape from nihilism? We're going to get through nihilism by seeing it through, by going through that process, intensifying it, accelerating it until we kind of emerged out the other end. And maybe this is what's happening. There may be a prima facie case for thinking so. However, there are also good reasons to think otherwise. Insofar as we, individually and collectively, live according to the values of this convergence between technology and neoliberalism, it seems we adopt values that we did not create from our own lives. Values that belong to the technological process, neoliberal political economy, and increasingly the pattern of work in the 21st century. I'm thinking here of some interesting work that I like, certainly by the sociologist Richard Sennett, on how conditions of work in the 21st century are promoting new kinds of values which we find ourselves obliged to take on. Insofar as the life I lead is shaped by values that do not emerge from my own struggle with adversity, then it looks as though my life is shaped by values imposed on it from outside. Whether such values are regarded as ideal, belonging in supersensory, or simply derived from processes and forms of life that are not mine, may not matter. The result is still that my life is governed by values it did not generate. And therefore, to the extent that I affirm those values, I repeat the first conditions of nihilism, as Nietzsche described it: submission to values that do not spring from my life. Assuming that one can still speak of a life that is mine, of my life, without assuming the existence of a substantial subject and so forth, but I think one can do that. It is worth asking at this point whether such a view in effect casts me here in the role of the reactionary hanging on to an ideal of what human life is that is no longer reflected in the world, not only is no longer reflected in the world around me, but in addition is itself tainted with nihilism and therefore not even desirable. By way of a conclusion, let me offer two reasons why I think this may not be the case. The positivism that lies deeply within neoliberalism means that the self overcoming it promotes takes place only in a narrowly defined form of life. Even when the terms of economic analysis have been extended from the strictly economic sphere to all aspects of life, it is the language of investment and return that dominates everywhere. Man becomes homo economicus. Now what I'm thinking of here is that, for example, Gary Becker says, talking about this, look, when I'm extending the idea of human capital and investment in oneself and so on to a broader sphere, it doesn't necessarily mean that I have to work out what the financial return is on my going to the pictures tonight or going to the pub instead of staying at home preparing something for tomorrow. Because that too can be understood as an investment, and I get a return out of it. I get some pleasure from it. I may meet some new people. So everything can still be understood in this way, even though it's not tied specifically to financial return. But here's the: first of all, you always have the language of investment and return operating, and secondly, it seems to me that this way of thinking leads to a position where the kind of but is a bit weak in that situation, where you just say, yes, but I'm not really going to read all these books and go to the theatre or this restaurant because I'm for any financial gain. I'm just doing it because I want to go, but somehow there's always a but. By doing so, don't you become the kind of person that might enhance their capital in some way? Might that not lead to impress people later, with the kind of people you need to impress at certain times, or whatever it might be, right? There's always that nagging thought of the possibility of return that seems to come in behind. As a consequence, anyway, self-overcoming in this context could be said to be no more than an empty shell of what Nietzsche intended, because of this sense of it just being associated with accumulation of capital, understood in this albeit broader sense perhaps, but still identifiably economic sense. It looks like an empty shell perhaps to what Nietzsche might have intended by the idea of self-overcoming and therefore life, and in fact closer to something that looks like self-consolidation, the accumulation of oneself as capital, even if this requires upgrading oneself continually. By contrast, Nietzsche's philosophy surely calls for the self overcoming not just within this framework of life, but of this life, i.e. that homo economicus itself, as such, should be overcome, should lead to its own overcoming. And economic analysis therefore give way to new forms of evaluation. This I'm happy to accept as what he intended all along. I may be flippant for a moment, it's not his fault that we're where we are with austerity and zero-hour contracts and all the rest. Second, so that's the first reason why maybe this conjunction of technology and neoliberalism doesn't represent a form of life that could be understood because it's autonomous and dedicated to continual self-overcoming as something that we were looking for to emerge through the intensification of nihilism as a possible way beyond. The second reason why this might not be the case is this: human capital theory and neoliberalism leave very little room in which to establish a point of resistance outside its logic or beyond its reach. However, Foucault may provide a useful resource here, and I wrote that down this afternoon and thought, oh no, I'm describing Foucault as a resource. He's become standing reserve. Oh well, never mind. Foucault may provide a useful resource here. In his late writing on the government of the self and the hermeneutics of the subject and the care of the self, these topics, he emphasised the importance of establishing a form of relation to oneself that is insulated from other power relations. which means you do not enter into other power relations in order to establish this relation to oneself. At the same time, your relation to oneself is held apart from other power relations which are going on around you. This is exactly, it seems, what is missing in the neoliberal technological model, where my engagement in the practice of self-overcoming, understood as the enhancement of myself as capital, and does precisely the reverse, exposing me to power relations that represent the governmental practice of neoliberalism. If the affirmation of life is to be understood at an individual level, then this exposure must be avoided. Finally then, to sum up, if the conjunction of technology and neoliberalism does constitute a form of life that is autonomous and creates its own values, as people like Galen, Alul, Jonas and others have suggested, and I'm sort of pulling together bits and pieces here, if that is the case, and if this life exerts its influence over human life by promoting these particular values, its own values, making them attractive or even unavoidable, then it seems that we're left with two alternatives, truly speaking at least. Either one agrees that it does represent an overcoming of nihilism, in which case the critics of neoliberalism are reactionary upholders of an ideal of humanity that Nietzsche has shown to be deeply implicated in the history of nihilism. Or one does not agree with this, in which case one needs to say in what way the description of what would constitute a form of life capable of such an overcoming of nihilism is incomplete. That is to say, I started with a suggestion that the overcoming of nihilism required the emergence of a form of life capable of affirming itself and in doing so creating values for its own promotion and growth. Now, that appears to be what you get with this convergence of technology and neoliberalism. So if you say, ah yes, but it's not that, what was wrong with the original definition? Was it incomplete? Is there something missing? Or have we misunderstood what's going on with technology and neoliberalism? That's my question. There we go.
Thank you.
Clearly is in his outline
more than one gap, probably, of that sort of kind. But I was just trying to get the map ideas out as the best I could sort of put them together. I think that's a it's a good question. I'm not fully sure where my answer would go on that. I think that certainly, had I got a bit more time, one of the things I would like to have done was to come back to the question of technology and what its effects are, if you like, today. Because here, clearly, it's drawn very largely negative terms, in the sense that it's positive in the sense of look at all the amazing things it can do, but it's presented in very problematic terms. Whereas I appreciate that one may be able to, one certainly could go some way down this road, I'm just not sure how far in the end, to looking at ways in which technology, for example, allows different forms of social interaction, community, engagement between people, forms of activity and so forth, which represent precisely forms of resistance to the neoliberal kind of grab of everything into this thing. And I think the Italian theory is strong on that stuff, right? And that might well be something that could develop easily. I'm not sure. In the end, something that still nags at me a little bit around this, as I suppose it's there is something that sort of nags at me that I've not found myself able to kind of really put my finger on why I maybe do or don't find that line in the end completely convincing. But I'm afraid that's something I just have to say. Yeah, I think you're right that there is when you take it straight down the class analysis or through the Italian sort of route to think about autonomia and so on. For me, the important thing would be looking at ways in which you can use technology, because the people I've referred to, Galen and Lul, they're writing mainly kind of 20, 30, 40 years. It's not bang up to date analysis of technology. New things are possible, people are doing different things with it, and so different things may become possible. Now, I suppose my question is how then do you weigh up those possibilities and what happened there against the kind of story which I've outlined here. Does that mean that technology becomes something neutral again, that we can use, that can get turned into something which is kind of not apparently doing anybody too many favours in this particular configuration, but possibly, you know, you can do something different with it? So I don't know where that goes. That's, I suppose, part of my hesitation.
Yeah, no. Maybe we can come back to something that occurs to you as the questions go on. Henry, next.
A really good paper today. Thanks a lot for that. But I suppose my question comes from a slightly different angle about alternatives and issues with it. You sort of presenting a view of humanity is caught within this system where everything is made commensurable through the technological and the economic conjunction of the two. And I suppose when you're talking about Foucault and explaining this Foucault considers himself relations internal and escapes from the system of power relations, the figure that kind of came to mind actually was Kierkegaard. And also the figure of maybe the tax collector. Mm-hmm. Who clearly is very much on the surface and on the outside caught within a commensurable system. particularly in 19th century Denmark, but yet preserves this in and around precisely because it escapes from the economy because it's incommensurate, and so it's almost like epistemologically it simply doesn't exist for the ethics of the time. So, I mean, I guess, if you think there's any possibility that incommensurability, simply because it can't be absorbed within that technological model, provides another route of escape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the fact that, that there might be something that can't be understood in terms of human capital might provide a sort of a foundation for an ethic that opens something different. Ironic.
I would think very absolutely. I would agree. Yes, absolutely. That would be, I think, precisely the moment that one needs to find. And I hadn't thought of that particular instance, but yes, that would be exactly the kind of thing.
Right.
You'll be probably getting see a theme emerging here, which is I am, as I said, fully aware that there's lots of kind of areas in which this could be developed, might go, gaps, areas, ways in which you could develop this thinking, and I'm not averse to them in any way. Really, I'm looking forward to hearing the way they, you know, what you, comments you may have. I agree with that, certainly, yes.
My question is just on the clarification. Could you rehearse again for me the argument for the argument for acceleration, accelerationism, accelerationism in relation to the conversion of technology and neoliberalism as a possible mode for overcoming nihilism? So can you rehearse that? And also, I mean, does it carry any weight? Does it make any sense?
Well, that. Your question, does it make any sense, is mine. I mean, it seems to me that on the face of it, it does.
That's my question. Why
on the face of it? And then precisely what I think is very interesting is to say, well, on the face of it does, and yet something looks wrong here. So what is it that's wrong? Where are the gaps? What is maybe the question, maybe the situation was badly put to begin with, or maybe there's something that needs to be added in some way. You know, that's precisely my question. Now, the way I put it was that if we're not going to respond to nihilism by retreating frantically and saying, let's try and shore up the old values and or put some new ones in their place, simply, then one of the alternatives which is to arise from Nietzsche is that we say we affirm nihilism to the point where recognizing that there are no values, there isn't anything to go with, there is nowhere to go, this is the way he describes it, end up affirming our own ability to sustain that situation, if you like, that life therefore becomes affirming itself simply by virtue of the fact that it's run out of other values to look to in the heavens or whatever, right? So that the way to pass beyond nihilism is through affirmation of nihilism and let that historical process take its course. Now, what might represent an overcoming of nihilism? The emergence of a form of life which is capable affirming itself, and in doing so, of creating values, rather than taking them from anywhere else. That's my key formula, as you would say. Then looking at the way in which technology has been described, and then in particular putting it in conjunction with neoliberalism, it looks as if that's kind of what we've got on the face of it. We've got a form of becoming, as we say, which increasingly is identified with life because it's become us through us becoming human capital, which is about self-overcoming, affirming its, and which has led to the creation of its own values, to do performance and
efficiency and all the rest of it. It superficially ticks the boxes, and yet something doesn't feel right. So what is it that's wrong here?
So the suggestion is not that we affirm the value of the convergence of the
right, okay. That's not my suggestion, no, for sure. My point is that if... Sorry, I hope I'm not just simply repeating myself. My point is that if we are to see our way through beyond nihilism, then, as I say, rather than resisting it, we see that there is a possibility of its own self-overcoming, like in the Nietzscheans, the fashion in which movements can lead to the practice of self-overcoming. What is going to emerge at the end of it? This idea of life which is capable of affirming itself and thereby creating new values and so on. So that's what, if we could see that happening, we think, maybe we're coming out of the end of nihilism. Maybe this is what the future may hold. A post-nihilistic future. Maybe this is it. And yet on the face of it, that's what we get with this convergence of technology and nihilism. And yet, it doesn't seem right. Okay. So why isn't it right? I keep on repeating, murmuring slightly. Does that... I'm not sure if it's made it any clearer.
I would just end up repeating myself. There's something I'm not getting, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, but maybe there's...
I was interested because it's something, it's an important one that you mentioned sort of in passing, the issue that for Nietzsche says that we can build out my life and then a substantial project. So I wondered if you could say to expand on it, and I'm in sympathy with that, because you talk about self overcoming and any kind of deliberate response to nihilism or project of transformation.
Yeah.
There needs to be some notion at least of agency, and
yeah.
I certainly agree that as my reading Nietzsche is also there is a deliberate but I suppose rather than think we're supposed to be allowed to talk about my life or my self overcoming or have this notion of project as a kind of response to others, and how do you reconcile that with, as you say, the lack of substantial subject, the notion of the multiplicity of self?
My way of thinking about this really is through Foucault, who I know perhaps rather better. And there you have the idea that the subject can construct itself through a form of self-relation, which is always mediated by knowledge, in Foucault's case. And then we start coming back onto your hatch, because we start talking about truth and knowledge. But it seems to me that the way Foucault talks about it is there isn't a substantial subject, because there's no subject which starts off and then kind of engages in some exploration of the world and interacts with it subsequently in any way like that, but rather is always constructed out of the materials it has available to it, basically, in the world around it, and sort of which through a kind of fold back or reflection back upon itself, which is a practical work rather than simply a kind of a conscious act of reflection. So I mean, that's how I essentially understand it.
So the bit you said about Foucault at the end was quite quick, and I was trying to grasp that as well. You're talking about avoiding particularly government totality, then.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you can't avoid the power relations. Would you agree that it's still the case, even in Leibniz, that we're always interfacing with power?
we are all clearly always interconnected, but I don't actually have the text with me. It's on the very last page of the hermeneutics of the subject. He writes that the government of the self requires the constitution of a relation to oneself that I don't think I may be overstated using the word insulate, but separates itself from relations with others, and political relations, power relations with others. Right. Now that's because it seems to me that his point is twofold, and I think I mentioned it. On the first hand, the first is that I constitute myself the relation to myself as far as possible without implicating others in that, in order that they are not instrumentalised in my constitution of myself as a subject, so I don't involve them in my drama of constituting myself as a subject. But it cuts both ways, of course, because it would also mean that as far as that were possible, you achieve a certain kind of freedom from those political power relations and forces, which I think is always a good point. You can never escape it completely, but your aim is to reduce it, to try to achieve something like a form of autonomy through those relations. The greatest degree of autonomy that you can from it, really. I mean, it seems to me the same sort of message that you read going back to the History of Sexuality, Volume 1, where it says, you know, everybody thinks they're liberating themselves by speaking out about their sexuality and declaring themselves, you know, here, there and everywhere, where all they're doing is making themselves into targets for discursive relations of power. You know, it's not liberation at all, it's actually the reverse. So what is the canny thing to do in that situation? Shut up. You know, you're better off doing that than you are kind of saying, hello, here I am, come and get me, kind of thing. So it's the same. I mean, I'm being a bit flippant, but the same. You're never going to escape those relations completely, but you move strategically within them. It's not an all or nothing, but there are still degrees which are meaningful in one way or the other. Sorry? Do I think there's a kind of Nietzschean solitude in the end? I don't know.
A sort of movement away from others.
Yeah. I don't think there is quite that, no. I think Foucault is fully aware that he's always kind of connected and to power relations around him, society around him, to a political reality, governmental reality, or however one likes to describe it. But that, on the one hand, is unavoidable, but is also positive, because it is precisely through those connections that one acts and has consequences, one's actions have consequences for those around one and so forth. So it cuts both ways in that sense. But at the same time, he is, I think, quite eager to circumscribe a certain space for that subjectivity, which is, as far as possible, sheltered from simply being too much exposed to those connections and relations.
Sorry,
yeah,
Chris. So I read an interesting review of article called Fashionable Violence. I thought it was interesting
afraid I haven't heard of the article, but it does sound like the kind of thing. I mean, where I'm based, Staffordshire University has got a big thing about the what it calls Staffordshire graduates, and it defines a Staffordshire graduate in terms of employability, entrepreneurship, and entrepreneurialism. Which is a surprisingly fine set of distinctions for the university. So yeah, they're all the same thing, I think.
One way or another.
I'm sorry, yes. Yes.
And
And I agree, because I mean, I keep owning up to all these things which are kind of gaps and shortcomings, because this is kind of something about kind of bolted together series of ideas in some way, with lots of areas which require further development. I'm quite well aware of that. Take the issue of nihilism first, although the issues of nihilism and life that you mentioned are both very important here, and actually it seems to me the kind of answer I want to give is perhaps the same in both cases, and actually that kind of indicates there's a connection here. But yes, Heidegger was used kind of fairly strategically here to kind of this kind of bridge piece from the Nietzsche through to the other pieces on technology I wanted to talk about, where you get this stronger sense of the autonomy of technology. And you're absolutely right, of course, that he has a different understanding of nihilism, and that if we bottom that out a bit further, then we'd be heading in a different direction. You mentioned two things. Let me just try and put a few of these things together. That Heidegger would be, with regard to the notion of life, maybe there was a slightly too naturalistic conception of life, kind of lurking at the...
Yes,
life
free of technology.
Yeah, agreed. Again. And that maybe Heidegger would be suspicious of such a naturalistic conception of life. And I agree. I think he would be. And that Foucault might be suspicious of the kind of a certain monumental nihilism big end that was, which I, and again, I'm a bit, I agree, which is why I said right at the very beginning, I nearly put it in a kind of Foucauldian terms, but when I said that I'm interested in kind of what nihilism has become, it was precisely to try to say, well, look, I'm sketching this out a bit, you know, hastily here, but I don't want to say that in the end there is nihilism. Let us just see how nihilism with a capital N kind of just simply plays itself out, as if nihilism is always going to be the same thing in history. Rather, I mean, I like Foucault's the way Foucault talks about this. He says, well, let's imagine that universals don't exist. Let's imagine that madness doesn't exist. Why do people find it necessary to talk about it here or here? How do they do it? And then they start building it up from that level. I mean, I think I'm much more attracted to that way of thinking. So that would mean perhaps, yes, maybe indeed nihilism shouldn't be treated simply as too monumental, as you say, and maybe life too requires a similar treatment, right? One of the ways in which it seems to me that one could begin to answer the question that I posed would be around life and around the kind of specificity that one might need to introduce to that idea, right? So let me just explain what I mean. I've tried to sort of sketch out why, if perhaps, albeit a slightly crude definition of what an overcoming of nihilism might look like from a Nietzschean perspective, when we follow a story through about technology and neoliberalism, it looks like we might have something a bit like that. So, is it? What's happening there? Actually, if we then say, well, actually, no, it's not, it seems to me that one of the ways we can begin to flesh that out is by saying the shortcoming with the original definition which that casts light on, should we say, is that it was too monolithic, it was too universal. There isn't life, there are lives. And actually, we need to take the specificity of that far more seriously. Perhaps from the very beginning, and then we would look at it and go, well, the point of departure that I set out here in that case is wrong. The overcoming of nihilism isn't the emergence of a form of life, as if life could be something which was, you need to be immediately far more specific about what that could be and about what's involved. And then when you came around to the nihilism, to this form of apparently life at the end with technology and neoliberalism, it's not monolithic, it's not what life has become, it's just one particular form of life which you no longer feel any, there's no longer a compulsion to say, this is what life has become. Because there are many, as the first question was sort of saying, you can begin to articulate all kinds of different kind of ways in which one engages in life and forms of individuality, communication, relations and so on, which could stand outside it or alongside it in different ways. I think the point is absolutely right. The main way in which it seems to me that the kind of account I've outlined here would need to be developed further would be to be far more circumspect about life and nihilism actually as concepts which run through it. Right? And in doing so, it seems to me what appears to be this problematic or surprising for the connection between what technology and neoliberalism present us with and life as a form of life which is, might represent the overcoming of nihilism, that kind of tends to start to fall away when you're no longer talking about life, nihilism, but rather simply forms of life, possibilities within that. What were you on about anyway?
All right.